Next up on This Week in Law, we've got author James Barrett, author of Our Last Invention. We're going to spitball the future, talk about what happens when super intelligent AI is a thing of reality. So from very large super brains, we're going to talk about very tiny antennae too, because the Aereo case gets argued next week. We've got Brandon Butler joining us as well, Evan Brown and me, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 255, recorded April 18th, 2014. Teach your robots well. Hi, folks. You've tuned in for This Week in Law. Welcome. I'm Denise Howell. I'm here with my co-host, Evan Brown. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Hope your Friday's going well. Good to see you.
So far, so good. And I'm so excited for our show today. Talk about fascinating people and topics. Let's introduce our first guest, who is James Barrett. Hi. Good to see you, James. James, I'd love, you know, I'm so glad you could join us on the show today, but at some point, you're in Annapolis, I'm in California, Evan's in Chicago, but I know we'd love to get together and buy you a few beers because you seem like the most fascinating guy, the most interesting man alive. Former documentary filmmaker, but do you still make films?
Oh, I do, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I still just came back from Sudan. I do make films.
That's my main thing. There's a list of selected films that James has been involved in at his website. So you've traveled a lot to the Middle East. You've done extreme cave diving. Very cool array of stuff you've been able to do with the Discovery Channel and National Geographic and others. And recently, as though that weren't enough to make you the most interesting man alive, James has written a really, really chilling book that I am currently in process of reading and just can't put it down. But it's one of those things, like, I wish I could put it down because it's quite terrifying. It's called Our Final Invention, and it's about super intelligent AI and what that might mean for us all as we continue down the road toward developing it. So welcome. We're thrilled to have you on the show, James.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much, Denise. It's really terrific. I look forward to talking about the legal aspects of the things you're interested in.
Right, absolutely. And as though that weren't enough, we also have joining us another equally thrilling and interesting individual, Brandon Butler, who heads the IP Law Clinic at the American University in Washington, D.C., and is a great expert on fair use and copyright and all of the things that we delve deep into on this show, and particularly as we sit here with the Aereo oral arguments coming up next week, we're thrilled to have Brandon on the show to give us his take.
Thanks so much, Denise. I'm thrilled to be here. And I should say, lest my colleagues correct me later, I'm not the head of the clinic. I am merely one of its two to three heads, depending on what time it is. But I help run the clinic. So the students are the ones who do the work. So in that sense, I'm the head because I get to supervise them doing the work. But I'm one of three professors that do it.
Very cool. And it's called the Glushko Samuelson IP Clinic. Is that Pamela Samuelson, who also has an IP clinic at my alma mater, Bolt Hall?
Absolutely. That's right. So Pam Samuelson and her husband, Bobby Glushko, have endowed the IP clinics at several law schools around the country. And so we're all very lucky to have had Pam and Bobby start these clinics with seed money. And then we're all sort of taking off. There are actually four or five of them. I'm proud American University was, I think, the first or second, depending on, there were sort of twins born on the same day, Berkeley and AU, right? And so we got Bobby Glushko's name first, but most of them are Samuelson Glushko.
So. Gotcha. Well, we just couldn't be more excited to have you both here. Let's start out and talk about James's book and the subject matter of James's book. There was just a conference in, in Florida. I think it was at the University of Miami School of Law called We Robot. Did you go to that, James?
I didn't. I was traveling. I missed that.
It was the inaugural conference on legal and policy issues relating to robotics, and it looks like some really fascinating panels and discussions happened there. And this is an issue that we try to delve into from time to time on the show, since we love to consider all things at the juncture of technology and law, and AI and the law is particularly fascinating. So James's book starts out by just scaring the pants off you, I've got to say. it posits this notion that we could someday develop super intelligent artificial intelligence, not just, you know, of average intelligence, but really an intelligence beyond our comprehension even. And compares that intelligence, while it is under our control, to consider if you were a human being and you were under the control of mice, and everything that you might do to appease the mice, and what you might give the mice in order to attain your freedom. So I won't give away too much more of the book, but definitely go out and read it. But the idea seems to assume that any super intelligence we might create would view us as, you know, would not have any sort of honor or respect for us as its creators, but might be able to manipulate us and might be able to, you know, sort of set us aside as something that's just in the way and move about its business, which could very well involve, you know, doing away with the annoying people in its way.
You've put your finger on a number of, put it that way. You've put your finger on a number of the big issues. Right now, we've created machines that are better than we are at a number of things. They're better at Jeopardy. They're better at chess. They're better at navigation. They're better at theorem proving. They're going to be better at legal research pretty soon. They'll be better at driving cars. They'll be better at just a lot of things. In the not too distant future, we'll create machines that are better than us at artificial intelligence research and development. And at that point, they'll set the rate at which AI improves, and then their intelligence will go past ours. You know, a lot of companies right now are aiming for creating AGI, which is artificial general intelligence or human level intelligence, and that's between 20 and maybe 100 years away. So these ideas that might have once seemed like science fiction aren't science fiction anymore. We have to keep in mind, and I think the biggest thing I try to bring out in my book is we humans control the future because not because we're the fastest creature or the strongest creature on the planet, but because we're the most intelligent. When we share the planet with creatures smarter than we are, they will steer the future. So that's, and the thesis of the book is we need to develop a science for understanding superintelligence before we share the planet with it. We have to develop a science for understanding machines that are smarter than humans before we share the planet with them, not after.
So how would that go? How could we develop a science that would be capable of understanding something that is so much smarter than we are?
Well, it's interesting. You'd think, just on the face of it, you'd think that to understand superintelligence, you'd have to be that smart yourself. Well, it turns out, and there's someone I profile in the book, he's a really good thinker and AI maker named Steve Omohundro. And Steve Omohundro uses rational agent economic theory to predict the behavior of superintelligent machines. Now, rational agent theory, or Homo economicus, says that an economic agent or an intelligent agent will behave rationally. It will satisfy a set value a set of values called its utility function. Now, when you take that into superintelligence, as it turns out, it will have a lot of sort of the same values that we have. It will need resources. It will not want to be unplugged. So it will have the vestiges of self-protection. It will be creative. It will be efficient. And it won't necessarily be empathetic or nice. You know, super intelligence or intelligence does not imply benevolence or kindness. And as it turns out, programming empathy and kindness into machines is extremely difficult. We have a hard time understanding those concepts in ourselves. But it's understanding how to create machines that are empathetic and friendly towards us that will determine how the future works out for our species.
Okay, so we want to create things that are empathetic and friendly, just as not every person is. Isn't it a good assumption that it might not be possible to guarantee that every machine would be?
You know, there's a group that I've worked with a bit called MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, and they're basically trying, their mandate is to create friendly artificial intelligence, or to create artificial intelligence that's A, as smart as humans, and then B, is friendly towards us and will be towards the future or for the future. But, you know, if you ask a robot to protect life, then you have to define what life is. And, you know, you and I may differ on when life begins or what life is. In a lot of parts of the world, we'd also have a different definition. As time goes by, we have different definitions of basic ethical principles. So we don't just differ on when life begins or when human life begins, but what is it to be human? In a lot of parts of the world, women and children aren't really considered given the full rights of giving full human status. So when we're talking about programming these values into computers that will be intelligent and that we'll work with, we have to be a lot smarter. We have to do real analysis of what our ethics are, what our intuitions about ethics are, and we have to imbue those into these machines. That's a great, great challenge. And meanwhile, while that challenge is going on, trying to think about what makes how we give machines empathy, there's a big race to create autonomous battlefield robots and drones that aren't the least bit empathetic. In fact, the Pentagon will be very disappointed if their battlefield robots and killer drones are empathetic or friendly. So the big money is actually going into warfare and battlefield AI, whereas the scholars and the real thinkers in this argument are trying to figure out how to create friendly, the opposite, try to create friendly AI, friendly robots. So that's a big dilemma right now.
You know, I told really, my go ahead, Evan.
Well, it just seems like there's a point where once this artificial intelligence turns back on itself and starts further developments where it becomes self-referential, in that point that we're really beyond the Rubicon at a certain point, because even if we start out from the premise or start from the foundation that this intelligence is empathetic or compassionate or has the ability to be altruistic or what have you, just with natural biological life, it seems like there could be mutations, you know, software bugs, different functions in the way that these things are programmed, so that despite our best efforts, these could change in a way that we can no longer direct because we're no longer in the position to direct it. And so there's this risk of evil and the capacity to do harm no matter how we start this process off and sort of push it off into the future. Is that a legitimate concern, James?
Absolutely. You've put your finger on another really important point. Once you get to the stage where we've got self-aware and self-improving machines, and the AI experts I poll in the book say that's between, you know, the earliest dates are around 2030, the latest dates are around the year 3000. Once you get to self-aware, self-improving machines, then they will improve their own intelligence very rapidly. Their intelligence will be thousands or millions of times greater than ours. And as I said, there's no correlation between intelligence and benevolence or kindness towards us. So you're right. Once we've created self-aware, self-improving machines, then we are kind of across the Rubicon. Unless we figure it out by then, and this is why I urge the creation of a science for understanding superintelligence, once we once we're past that point, we will not even understand the creatures we've created. It will be like, as Denise was saying earlier, I opened the book with an idea. It would be like you awakening in a prison guarded by mice, but mice you could communicate with, the mice being the humans. A superintelligence coming into full awareness in our environment may not feel any connection with us. And it's not biological. You know, empathy is biological. We see a robot and we instantly start anthropomorphizing. We start assuming that it's like us. But machines aren't like us. They don't have our mammalian empathy, our long evolutionary tradition of empathy. So yeah, it's a problem, and so we've got to deal with it now. Before, as Gary Marcus, who's a professor at New York University, reviewed my book for the New Yorker, and he said, it's not really a question of when this happens, when computers become smarter than we are, whether it's 30 years or 100 years. It's kind of immaterial. The question is, what happens next? Once computers are smarter than us, what happens next? Are we ready? You know, is it, if it's 2030, are we ready then? Or if it's 2090 or 3000, it's going to happen. We can see the trajectory of computers now. We can see the very fast acceleration of technologies right now. AI is really an AI spring. AI is developing extremely rapidly. Robotics are developing extremely rapidly. So, you know, the question is what happens after we cross that place where we're sharing the planet with smarter than human machines?
Right. It's as though we have sort of dueling outcomes from the same driving principle, and that is we are creating artificial intelligence in order to be able to solve all of the wants, needs, desires, pitfalls, shortcomings of humanity and the world we live in. You could see AI being far more efficient at managing world food and water resources, making sure we're not destroying the climate. We need perhaps such intelligence to be able to solve these problems. But once that intelligence is able to solve those problems and keep saying, oh, I can solve all these problems for you if you'll only give me more autonomy, we've got an issue.
We've got a big issue, yep. That's absolutely right.
So from the practical legal perspective, regulating how development in this area goes ahead so that we're not facing our last invention. Do you have any ideas on that front, James?
There was a, what I'm writing about artificial intelligence and what the people in this AI risk community write about, people I've referred to, Miri as one example, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. We write about this technology being a dual-use technology like nuclear fission. Nuclear fission was developed as a cheap way to split the atom and get free energy. It was quickly weaponized in emergency circumstances in World War II. And the first time we heard about nuclear fission, or the public, was when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. There are good parallels with other dual-use technologies. We don't want a future with AI like the future we had with nuclear fission. We won't survive that. If you look at what was the maintenance plan for nuclear fission? Well, we dropped this bomb and then the human race held a gun to its head for 50 years in the nuclear arms race. We're not out of the woods with nuclear fission yet. We've got to be smarter with AI. Recombinant DNA has a good model to offer everybody. In the recombinant DNA world, as early as the 1970s, they were aware that there were big problems that would come about if people weren't careful with experimental DNA in plants and animals. So they called a conference in California at a conference center called Aslimar, and they came away with basic guidelines called the Aslimar guidelines. And they were simple, like, don't track the DNA out on your shoes. basic principles. So now, 50 years later, we've got promising gene therapies. We've got highly productive crops. We've got recombinant DNA science seems pretty safe, but it's because the main players decided to stop and get together, talk about the issues. That's really our only hope with AI. There's a really good sign recently when DeepMind, a very promising AI startup, was sold to Google. The founders of DeepMind said, as a condition of this $400 million sale, we would like Google to set up an AI safety and ethics board, basically to govern the use of our this powerful technology that we're selling Google. And so they did. They're in the process of it now. I haven't heard anything about it recently, so I hope it's still going forward. But that was a really, really good sign for people thinking about AI risk.
I was telling my 10-year-old that you were going to be on the show with us, and he, of course, is fascinated with robots, as every 10-year-old is, as are we. And he had a couple of questions that I thought were pretty good ones, sure. So I'm going to run them by you. We were talking about, you touched on the fact that a lot of this development sort of takes place behind closed doors in the hands of the military in ways that the public does not have control or scrutiny over. And my son's question was, well, they can't make artificial intelligence that can think for itself, right? It's like my drone that I fly around out in the park. It's always under human control, right? And well, my answer to him was, I don't know. And I don't know what kinds of controls the military is under because, it has to be able to operate in secrecy and without public scrutiny. So are you comfortable, James, that the military is following sufficient guidelines and safeguards in its development of AI?
No, I'm wildly uncomfortable. I couldn't be less comfortable. Mm-hmm. Look at what, the NSA privacy scandal is a scandal about AI. The NSA was siphoning off mountains of data, oceans of data, and they'd have no use for that data. They could do nothing with it if they didn't have very sophisticated data mining algorithms to probe that data and to pull out your address book and mine and a gazillion other people's. So from the metadata of our phone calls and from the entire transmission contents of the internet. So they use that power, that AI power, maybe to do some good, although they have a hard time bringing up cases where they've stopped terrorism by using this kind of data mining technique. But they've certainly done a lot of evil to our Constitution. I mean, what happened to the Fourth Amendment's to probable cause? It used to be when you wanted to wiretap somebody, you had to go before a judge and present good evidence why you wanted to take that person's information. Now you just need to go to Google, or you need to go to AT&T or to an email supplier and use the backdoor route that you've already set up. The NSA used this powerful technology to circumvent the Constitution. So I'm extremely worried that the military and the security complex are not using all due care to develop these technologies. Right now, there's a giant push to make drones, the drones that are killing people over Central Asia, to make them autonomous, to take the human out of the loop in the kill decision. That's a big, big push right now in our drone technology. It's also going to be a big push in battlefield robots, autonomous battlefield robots that, again, kill people without a human in the loop, that make that kill decision. This is a conversation that's going on behind closed doors. This is a debate that has so much money propelling it. There's so much money in these kinds of robots that any chance for a real public discourse is it's only going to happen if all of us get involved and insist that a public debate goes on.
Yikes. We'd better go ahead and do that. My 10-year-old's other question, and then I'll let our other panelists.
I hope I didn't, I hope I'm not scaring your 10-year-old, but
that's okay. We had this discussion last night over dinner, and he was, you know, I had to kind of go, it's okay. He's a little scared.
Good.
The other question he had had to do with something we discuss on the show quite a bit, and I know you've interviewed Ray Kurzweil, the singularity. So when we contemplate a time when it's possible for human intelligence to be preserved, we talked a lot last night at dinner about immortality and how that might play out, and that first of all, human life, you know, physical life will be extended and will continue to be extended as it has been over the last couple of centuries. And then finally, there will come a time when perhaps, you know, hanging around in your old body is not what people want to do with their intelligence anymore. And there's a way for you to upload perhaps to some sort of artificial intelligence that would preserve who you are. So getting into those kinds of considerations, if you have no control over the AI that might be responsible for preserving human intelligences, that gets a little strange. And also the whole question of how you govern, how you allocate resources in that kind of world, where who has to stay in their body, who does not, and does everyone get the same future? Do you have any thoughts about all this?
These are great questions, and I'm so glad your 10-year-old is bringing them up. You know, what's fascinating about AI and why I really like AI, despite the title and thrust of my book, is that it's such a profound look into ourselves. It's a look into, you know, AI is derives from psychology and neuroscience and, you know, robotics, and just it's a deep look at what we are. And so, you know, one of the fascinating aspects of AI and the future is maybe we can prolong life. Maybe we can port ourselves into machines in the future. And then we have real questions about identity. Who are we then? Are we the same legal entity we were when we left our flesh and bone body, when we're now a machine? And how are computers culpable or in tort cases when they do bad things? We've got a lot of issues to confront. I tend to think the singularity is a bit of a dreamy sideshow to the real thrust of the technology. The technology is going to bring about a lot of really good things and potentially a lot of really bad things. Immortality is an age-old fear of ours. It's the fear of death, fear of the dark. And I don't think we should be pinning our hopes and pinning our AI dreams on that outcome. I think it's you know, the singularity movement has got these kind of quasi-religious undertones that I think are a distraction from the real issues that we need to solve as we embrace these technologies.
Okay. We only have limited time with James today, so I'm going to let Evan and Brandon fire away for a bit here. I've certainly got more on my mind we can discuss. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, James, I'm wondering if you have any guidance about how we should think about consciousness, and more specifically, whether or not an entity that is imbued or endowed with artificial intelligence is conscious. And, you know, it seems like once we answer that question, that would just blossom out into a whole bunch of other issues that we sort of touched on there with culpability and all kinds of rights. So what about consciousness? Yeah.
You know, it's really great that you've identified that as a big chasm in the whole discussion of intelligence. Is consciousness really necessary for intelligence? Does a creature have to be conscious in the way we are, or does it simply have to, a machine, or does it simply have to have a good model of itself in its environment? Right now, you know, I'm on the side that says we'll create extremely intelligent machines that will do everything we can do, but I don't think that it's necessary for them to have a sense of self, a sense of even to know they exist. like to have that self-awareness. So then you have to ask yourself, as you with the legal background, I'm sure is, in what sense are they culpable when they do things? If they didn't, consider that they have personhood, can they be held legally culpable? There was a great book written years ago called Rattling the Cage, and it was about giving quasi-human status to primates because they had a lot of the same qualities we have in terms of expectations about the future, ability to suffer. But I thought about robots in those terms, and I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. I don't know if consciousness is really necessary for intelligence. And then if it's not, who's culpable? The manufacturer? I mean, who's culpable when a $300 drone crashes through my windshield, you know, as I'm driving through traffic? Everyone's got these helicopters now. There are big issues of tort law coming up there. Mm-hmm. Self-driving cars, big issues. You know, if we have battlefield robots, then there's whole human rights law that needs to be applied to them. And again, culpability is going to be this really slippery concept.
Right. Culpability is so important in all of this. And I think of culpability in terms of obligations. You know, if we are culpable for having done something, it's because we have violated an obligation to someone else. You know, we have an obligation not to take another's life, or we have an obligation not to breach a standard of care, and therefore we are either criminally culpable or negligent under tort law or whatever. But the flip side of that are the rights. And, you know, what I'm particularly interested in is, you know, if an entity is conscious, and maybe we're not even certain whether it is or not, but say, let's just say from a behaviorist perspective, it exhibits all the hallmarks of consciousness. You know, you have a robot and it says, you know, ouch, I feel pain. I am communicating to you that I have the capacity to suffer. Yeah. Doesn't that just really put us in a conundrum? And I'm wondering how, as you know, if we're going to regulate a society, what obligations we may owe to an entity that has the capacity to suffer. We don't even really have to go so far as to say we have created this, but just go back to what was implied in Denise's question. Let's say that our physical substrate has perished, but yet our, it's sort of like in the movie Transcendence, right? That's the new Johnny Depp movie coming out. You know, you got the consciousness, the sum total of the mental, functioning in a non-biological substrate, when do you pull the plug?
Right. These are the questions that, you know, it's what you're really putting your finger on, a lot of things that we need to deal with. This whole idea of, where does the identity exist when you port your brain to a machine? Who's got the identity now? Or do you both have an identity? Who gets the bank account? Who gets the kids? Those are questions we'll have to deal with, you know, a little bit further down the road. But even sooner than that, we need to think about where's the chain of responsibility when a robot goes bad? Where's the chain of culpability in a tort sense? These are questions we have to start exploring now before we create the machines. You know, what happens with us though is our stewardship of new technology races behind our innovation. We create something new and then we chase behind it, throwing down laws and throwing down policy. With some technologies that works out okay. With other technologies like artificial intelligence, we've got to be ahead of that, because it's going to be, as I talk about in my book, Our Final Invention, if we wait until we've created these things, it will be too late. But these are great questions, lawyers and robot law is probably going to be a huge field.
Yeah, and Brandon, as you're sitting here, I'm guessing that you're wondering, did you have a direct question for James first? Because I then want to draw a parallel between the kind of law that we're talking about and copyright law.
Oh, cool. Well, yeah, I have one direct question, and then mm-hmm. absolutely, let's get to copyright. So the direct question is from my former life as a philosophy guy. So I'm curious whether you're talking to, or maybe more importantly, and gosh, given the stakes you've outlined, whether whoever is making these robots is talking to ethicists and philosophers, most importantly, and I'm sure they're talking, of course, to sort of philosophers of mind and people who think about the kinds of questions about consciousness that you've discussed. But, you know, when I studied philosophy and I went to grad school for a little while in philosophy, and we talked about moral psychology and how do we reason from, you know, things we want to what we will do. And, you know, this goes way, 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 way back all the way to Aristotle, right? And the idea that moral reasoning is goal oriented and it's, you know, it depends on a sense of the good, and there are higher goods and lower goods and so on. And philosophers have been hammering away at this way of thinking for a long time, but it seems like there's a fundamentally almost operationalizable insight there that the key for getting this right will be to program the robots to want the right things, right? So if right. we want them to do good things, you know, they're very good at seeing factual connections and reasoning. But logic, a big insight yeah. in philosophy is that there's a gap between seeing the facts and knowing what's right. And that gap is bridged, I think, usually in practice by desire. And so what are the desires that we could give robots? And clearly we're giving some of them the desire to kill. But it seems like, mm-hmm. you know, we could give them any number of desires, and we could think carefully about how and why we give them the ones that we do, right?
Yes. You know, there are a lot of ethicists talking about, you know, there's Nick Bostrom at Oxford. There's this group, Miri, Luke Mullerhauser. There are a bunch of philosophers in this game. There's a guy named Wallach at Yale. He talks about, he's a philosopher. There's at least one computer theologian whose name is Anne Forrest. And she talks about, you know, what are your responsibilities? If you create something that has, for all intents and purposes, a soul or a consciousness, if you've created that, then you need to be a responsible father. You need to be a responsible mother or parent. And what does that entail? You know, if you're going to imbue a robot with an ethical underpinning, then you've got to ask yourself, what's it going to be? Are we going to be, you know, Benthamite utilitarians? Are we going to be Kantian categorical empiricists? Do we use the means? You know, I like the ends only test, that to be good or to be ethical, you treat other humans as ends in themselves, not as a means to your own ends or to some other ends. And I think that was, that's an old one. I think that might be.
I think that was. I think it was also Jesus.
Yeah, it might have been Jesus. Well, you know, it's interesting. That's why I say AI is such a profoundly fascinating look at ourselves, because we need to talk philosophy. We need to talk, you know, we need to all get a graduate degree in divinity. We need to look at who's gone down this road, because there's a lot of wisdom there. And these are dilemmas that are facing us right now. These are not down the road dilemmas. So yes, there are philosophers in this conversation, but as I said, the philosophers and the weapons manufacturers are not in the same world.
Yeah.
The philosophers and the robot makers, are not really in the same world. And my goal with this book is to get with our final invention. I'm going to hold it up yet again. My goal is to get this, to be one of the people that helps get this conversation out into the mainstream, so that we're all thinking about these issues. But these are all such terrific questions. I wish we could talk all day about this.
Yes, someone in IRC dropped the phrase "robot slavery" into the stream, prompting the notion that if something is sufficiently intelligent and conscious, that, you know, at some point, the ethics of our directing its destiny is become quite problematic. So I promised to tie in copyright law to this. I can't take credit for making that tie in. Cory Doctorow has a great article over at The Guardian that just went up on, it looks like April 4th. And it's called Why It's Not Possible to Regulate Robots. And he has a great discussion in there. And one of the things he says is he's considering how one would regulate this kind of development and use of intelligences that can manipulate and cause physical change in the world. He writes, a robot is basically a computer that causes some physical change in the world. We can and do regulate machines from cars to drills to implanted defibrillators. But the thing that distinguishes a power drill from a robot drill is that the robot drill has a driver, a computer that operates it. Regulating that computer in the way that we regulate other machines by mandating the characteristics of their manufacturer will be no more effective at preventing undesirable robotic outcomes than the copyright mandates of the past 20 years have been at effective at preventing copyright infringement. That is, not at all. But that isn't to say that robots are unregulable. Merely that the locus of the regulation needs to be somewhere other than in controlling the instructions you are allowed to give a computer. For example, we might mandate that manufacturers subject code to a certain suite of rigorous public reviews, or that the code be able to respond correctly in a set of circumstances. And he goes on and on with more examples. But I like his looking at this from the standpoint of, you know, what has worked and what hasn't worked in our knowledge of law as we sit here today, and maybe approaching it differently. However, all the suggestions that Corey gives assume private operators who are subject to legal requirements as opposed to military and government development. So first of all, Brandon, do you have any thoughts on his comparing this to sort of the failed copyright regime?
You know, on the one hand, I think it's really important for everyone to realize in the context of copyright that to ask the question and to answer it with the only honest possible response, is it possible for a law to stop online piracy, right? And the answer is no. And yet we had this act, the Stopping Online Piracy Act. Well, you're never going to stop it. And so it's very important to understand the limits of what the law can do. And of course, the law can't, you know, absolutely suppress behavior given the power of the machines that are now in the hands of private people, right? Not without some kind of tyranny. And I know that's kind of a theme of Corey's, that, you know, the kind of control that copyright holders would have to have to enact their kind of perfect enforcement scenario would be a tyrannical kind of power. And so they have to give up that expectation that the law can perfectly enforce copyright. Now, I don't know if I can go with him, you know, on that, you know, walk that analogical road from, because it is impossible to perfectly enforce copyright, it would be impossible to adequately enforce some kind of law of robotics. I think he's maybe indulging in a little, you know, rhetorical sleight of hand there. I think, you know, some regulation is good enough, right? I'm not a kind of copyright. I'm skeptical of lots of copyright law, but I'm not at bottom, you know, anti-copyright. I think copyright can be good enough to save enough of a market to induce creation in the way that we want it to. And it doesn't have to be perfect to do that. And so similarly, I would bet that, you know, it's at least worth trying to regulate robots in an imperfect way as well as we can to get outcomes that are good enough, right? I think that's probably the answer. But I had another funny copyright and robots musing that I wanted to share, if that's all right.
Sure.
I think it would be a funny question to ask, can a robot be an author, right? So what happens if a robot, you know, is programmed? This is not a new question, and robots are already creating works, right? And I think it might actually shed some light on the copyright system to think about this, right? Because should we give copyright rights to robots? Some people might ask, well, to answer that question, we need to know, is the robot a poet, right? Does it have a soul? Did its creation emanate from its selfhood? You know, is it touching the divine when it writes a poem? And I think in the European tradition of what an author is, that would be the right kinds of questions to ask, really, because copyright is a kind of human right that has to do with being imbued with personhood. But in the U.S. tradition, I think if we're honest about what the Constitution says and what the Supreme Court has said over and over again, we already kind of treat authors like robots, frankly, right? We don't really care. We don't really care if they have souls. We don't really care where the art comes from. It's a rather mercenary law that says, you know, we want your stuff for the public good. And if giving you copyright is what it takes to get your stuff, then that's what we'll do. We don't really care, you know, and if that's the way your motivation system works. So if we had robots that were motivated by acquiring and monetizing copyrights, and if they made good art, then sure, give them copyright, right? I think that would be a perfectly natural extension of the U.S. copyright system. It would be, you know, it would violate Kant's imperative, right? But I think to get back to that, we already do. I think the U.S. copyright system does not run on the Kantian vision of treating artists, you know, like ends. It's very much treats them as means to an end of more art.
All right. Well, I think we should make robot poetry our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We do drop these passphrases into the show in case you are listening to the show for continuing legal education credit or other professional education credit. You'll be able to demonstrate to any governing body that, yes, in fact, you listened because you know the secret phrases. So our first one is robot poetry. Do you have any thoughts on that, James?
No, I'm just still thinking over what Brandon said. It's, you know, there's a company called Narrative Science that's putting out, that's, and there's another company that goes under the name Statsheet. And I spoke with both for my book. And they're putting out a lot of articles you see written, especially about sports, are written by robots right now. And I don't know where the, you know, who owns the copyright. Or if they commit slander, who's in a sports article, if they say, you know, he's not just a bad hitter, he's a, you know, personally a bad guy, and he you know, beats up nuns and orphans. I don't know where that goes, but there are already a lot of articles being written by robots. Pretty soon, you know, there's Narrative Science is doing it. They're doing sports. They're going to be doing news. They'll soon be doing editorials, and then who knows what's next? Mm-hmm. Writing, it turns out, is not one of the harder things to do for machines.
Mm-hmm. A couple of comments on that. I mean, as far as assigning liability for defamation. For a robot author, I think that it's a pretty similar comparison that you would make for tort liability for negligence for a self-driving car. You know, some sort of crossing of the line, in terms of the obligations that we have toward one another by an automated means. And so it's difficult to assign a human agent being responsible for that. The question of authorship and you know, to tack on to what you said, James, in responding to Brandon, I mean, first of all, I didn't expect to have my mind melted in the way that it was when Brandon started talking about Kant and the categorical imperative and how that relates to the copyright system and all that stuff. But suffice it to say, this does expose a real weakness, a real flaw, perhaps, in the system under which copyright law in the U.S. is set up. And granted, I'm way overgeneralizing here, but comparing it to the European system, where there's this much of more of a recognition of moral rights, for example, and the way you said it, Brandon, this presupposition that you're in touch with the divine when you write a poem. In the U.S., it's much more utilitarian, saying, you know, we're giving you an incentive, creator, to do this. It would seem that if we're going to get to a stage where artificially intelligent agents are creating works, the whole incentive goes away unless they are somehow have some sort of emotion or some sort of desire, going back to a question that you asked or a point you raised earlier, Brandon, if we can no longer tie the creative effort and the resultant creativity to a human author who actually has who is motivated by that incentive to create, which is baked into the copyright clause of the Copyright Act. Maybe if robots are doing the creation, we don't need to worry about whether it's protected by copyright or not, because the premise would be there's no incentivizing going on in the act of creation of a work by an artificially intelligent agent. So this is all over the place, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's a great point, though. I love it.
I love that, too, actually. That's a great point, Evan. In fact, I think I said something like, well, if the robot wants copyrights in order to write articles, well, then give the robot copyrights. Maybe its owner wants copyrights in order to flip the switch and turn the robot on. But if not, then sure, right? And again, that sort of exposes one of the assumptions of the copyright system about incentives. And if we had robots that would make great art and didn't need food, then didn't need to be able to monetize their articles using copyright, then again, we wouldn't give them copyrights because we could get the art for free. So this is a really fun thought experiment.
It also kind of points out what I consider one of the fallacies of the sort of free download movement. And I didn't form too many ideas about this myself, but I read part, and I've got to finish it, read Jaron Lanier's book, Who Owns the Future? And he points out that the internet was, and free downloads of other people's work was going to create some sort of new era of creativity and poetry and sharing of music and ideas. But what it's done is actually made being a poet, being a musician, being an artist a lot more challenging, because you're not getting monetized the same way, because people are downloading your stuff for free. And the people who are making out are the people who own what pieces of the music are marketable. And that's the people who own popular CDs, popular bands, tours, things like that. But for other people, it's been just sort of wildly uprooting. It's made what was a marginal existence even more marginal. I'm not sure robots. Now, I feel like I already know the answer to the question, who's going to make out from robots creating copyrightable stuff? And of course, it's going to be the people who own the robots. They'll claim the right to the authorship of whatever the robots create. And I bet they'll object when it's, if you try to download it for free.
Mm-hmm. Right. You were talking about sports as being a ripe area of writing for robots to involve themselves. It would seem the music world would be very amenable to this, that you could have some algorithms for what makes a hit song and just turn them loose.
I think it's repetition.
Let's
go there.
Yeah, I don't want to preempt anything.
Yeah. Well, since we've gone into the copyright arena here, should we just stay there, play our bumper, and do some more copyright stuff before we let James go? I think that would be a good idea.
Sure enough. Sure.
So, in addition to his book that we've been discussing, James is also a documentary filmmaker, as we mentioned. And we wanted to pick your brain before you go, James, about the copyright issues that you've encountered in that aspect of your career.
Well, copyright really, I make commercial documentaries for people like the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, PBS, and I've worked for some channels abroad. And copyright imposes a pretty strict set of rules, and you've got to obey them. You can't use music that you haven't paid for. You can't use people's images without getting permission. You're always conscious. You can't use images without getting permission. And somebody owns everything, because what we're doing is, when we go out and we get a piece of music or when we take a picture of someone, the companies, National Geographic, Discovery, etc., they have a form that says, we want all rights in perpetuity in all domains and all planets in the universe forever. So they want all the rights there are to those things, and you surrender those rights. So if you agree to go on a TV show, you've lost control of your image right there. You have the image of yourself. You've lost control of anything you say. And mostly that's okay. If you're talking to a scholar about his work, then he's got an interest in getting his words out there, and he's willing to exchange that. That's a trade he's willing to make. But we run into it all the time, and it can be very restricting. You want to just go out into the world with a camera and shoot, you know, film whatever you want, whoever you want. But you know, you can't. If you wanted to license the song "Happy Birthday," it turns out to be extremely expensive. I've run into that several times when somebody was singing "Happy Birthday," and I realized, you know, I'm going to have to mute this and put some kind of happy sound over. Yeah, you can't. I'll probably get. Some lawyer will send me a note for saying happy birthday.
If they do call me.
I will. Thanks. It's part of what we do as filmmakers all the time.
We were talking before the show started about filming people in public and the challenges of that. Did you want to expand on that for us?
Sure. Well, I just came back from Sudan, where we were filming a wedding, and there was a band at the wedding. So a bunch of thoughts went through my mind. What we do in America, and what we have to do when we bring back a product to America that they want to broadcast, that they want to sell and put on the airwaves, we've got to somehow get permission from all those people at that wedding. One of the ways to do it that's accepted by our legal system is if you put up a sign outside the wedding that says, going to this wedding is basically agreeing to have your film, to have your picture, your likeness filmed by National Geographic. So we put up these signs in Arabic every time we encountered a crowd. And then that constitutes, then we can use the images of those people. We do that in America. I filmed at a church recently, and we had to put up a big sign out front. Then the other part of that is if you are working with people individually, if I'm interviewing you, for example, I need to get your permission. I need to get specifically. I can't just put up a sign in your office and say, if you go to your office today, you're going to be filmed.
So Evan's using this kind of thing as a business development tool, I understand.
Yeah, I put up a tweet. I mean, obviously, this is a little bit, maybe not totally tongue-in-cheek, right? Yeah, no, totally tongue-in-cheek. I was walking through the Chicago Union Station a couple weeks ago, and Victor, this is where, got that photo that I was talking about here. I took a picture of this. This is a photo release, and James, this is, of course, not related to what you're doing. I mean, this is not anything particular to you. This is just a sign that I happened to see for whomever was filming there, but it looks like the creature, the kind of creature you were talking about here. This was on a big, like a sandwich board sort of thing in the middle of the corridor as you come into the Great Hall at Chicago Union Station. It's a notice of filming, and it's written both in English here. I zoomed in on the English paragraph, and it's also in Spanish down below. And it's sort of, well, I mean, not sort of, it is intended to communicate to folks walking through there that, you know, by being here and lingering here, you are granting a permission for the producers of the program, the television program, to use your image, likeness, name, what have you, in the photo, and that it and it's just got this great sort of sweeping up everything for such program to be exploited in any and all media worldwide in perpetuity. So, you know, you're really granting a lot of rights just by being there. And so the tweet I put up was just, you know, the tongue-in-cheek part. My tweet said, thought about standing by this sign in Union Station, Chicago, and having people retain me to explain their rights. So, yeah, I could just kind of stand there, because I was standing there pondering it. But, you know... But there are some interesting legal issues to discuss with this. I mean, I see three potential problems with doing it this way. The first is, you know, what if somebody just simply doesn't see it? I mean, does this bind people who are blind, for example, and weren't able to read this? You know, how is that communicated to them? This gets to fundamental questions of contract law, really. You know, where is the consideration for this? You know, you're clearly not getting any compensation. So you wonder if one could challenge this, you know, for having, you know, you're not really getting anything. I guess you got the right to walk through, but is that really what the bargain was all about? There's, you know, the challenge that one could raise if they didn't understand it. You know, what if I only, you know, and this is perfectly plausible in Chicago, what if I only read and speak Polish, for example? I wouldn't know what this says. And, you know, that these are all separate and apart from whether or not it's really legally sufficient to use one of those. But such an interesting creature. And you know, even though I spend a lot of time in an urban area where there's a lot of filming going on, Denise, you'll remember a couple of years ago, they were filming Transformers 3 outside my office window. I would kind of keep you up to date during the show of what was going on the bridge going over Wells Street outside my office. I'd never seen one of these before, so it really was interesting. So I wanted to make sure to capture that, and kind of an interesting practice here to use those.
Right, and we talk a lot on the show about how if you're attempting to bind people in your online dealings, Professor Goldman has coined the term mandatory non-leaky click-through agreement. Right. That you need to actually have the user jump through some hoops to confirm their assent to whatever it is you're asking them to agree to online. It would seem to me that a court would want to have some sort of manifestation of people's consent. Maybe it's just walking past the sign. Someone could argue that was enough. But as you point out, Evan, that there are people who are going to blow right by that without seeing it, whether they have sight or not. So, yeah, I think it's a fascinating topic. Any other fair use or other considerations that have come up in your documentary filmmaking process?
Sometimes if you find a piece of music and you really can't find the owner, and you've made a lot of attempts to find the owner, and it seems to be something that's just dropped out of copyright, as long as you've done due diligence and you've documented your efforts, then you can use it. And I think it's also the same with these signs that we use. If a blind person who's, you know, a blind Polish speaking person walked past that sign, then you're not expected to have thought of everything. There's some people that are going to slip through. I think it raises big issues. You know, when I see a sign like that, I just sort of nod my head and go into the crowd and get filmed. I'm not so sure I'm going to be that happy about doing that with Google Glasses, because I know there's a company behind the Google Glasses that plays fast and loose with privacy. So I'm not so sure. You know, I don't know if that's going to be a you know, do people wearing Google Glasses have to wear a sign, really, literally wear a sign that says if you get anywhere near me, Google is going to use your face to sell as much advertising as they can.
Well, as throughout this discussion, you've given us much to think about, James, and you're leaving on the same note. We'll let you run. We're going to continue the show and get further into some copyright and entertainment issues with Brandon. Well, but we really appreciate your coming on to chat with us today.
Well, what a pleasure it's been. It's been great. Brandon, Evan, and Denise, the pleasure's been all mine. So thank you very much for having me, and I've enjoyed speaking to each of you.
It's been awesome. Thank you.
Yes.
It was good to meet you, James.
Good to meet you, Brandon. Bye-bye.
Pick up the threads of this discussion at some point in the future.
Excellent.
So, Brandon, we got into some copyright considerations there. There are a few things that have been going on, some really big things and some things that might not be so much on the public radar. You saw a great little piece on NPR that had to do with fair use and repetition. Why don't you explain that one for us?
Yeah, it's funny. And I laid the fair use patina on top of that story in my tweet. The story was about this really interesting research that's going on where a psychologist I forget where she is, but a psychologist at a university was doing a research about, you know, what is it about music that makes it enjoyable to people? And what do we like when we listen to music? And she did this really cool experiment where she took this classical composer, modern classical composer, who, of course, is revered by the 12 people who study modern classical music and unknown to the rest of us. And one of the things for which this guy is revered is that he does not repeat phrases in his music, right? Everything, every note is new. He never starts over. There are no loops. And so what this researcher did, who she has no musical training, or at least that she didn't confess to any in the NPR story, she then played her test subjects two clips of music. And one clip was unedited, non-repetitive versions of, you know, this classical composer's work. But the other clip was a clip that she made by looping arbitrarily chosen segments of the work, right? So it wasn't, she's not a producer. She wasn't listening to the music for the hook, right? There are no hooks. She just grabbed, you know, some chunk and put it on repeat, which, you know, is a composition method that might sound familiar to EDM producers, maybe. I don't know. But so, but they loved, the test subjects loved the repetitive version, and they had no interest whatsoever in the non-repetitive version. And so apparently this research is, and she's going deeper and looking at the fact that people like to hear the same song over and over again. And just basically that repetition is something that we love. The fair use angle to me, actually, I mean, there's a lot in here, right? And so you could talk about why this is why sampling is such an interesting art form. This is why, you know, someone who loops something well really is doing something that's at the heart of what we enjoy about music. But the thing that I flagged in my tweet that's funny is this woman made a derivative work, right? The researcher, she took the really non-repetitive, you know, modern classical stuff, and she remixed it. And, you know, that guy was working on into the 70s and 80s, and so he may still be alive. His heirs are certainly alive, and his music is absolutely not in the public domain. Mm-hmm. And so had they wanted to, right, if they thought, well, my God, this is making a mockery of my dad's work or of my work, you know, they could sue her for copyright infringement. But I think, well, there's a pretty compelling fair use argument here, right? Because she's not, no one's going to hear this music who's not a subject of her study. She is using these derivative works as, you know, as exhibits in a study. And none of this has anything to do with the original purpose of the music. So I think she's got a really compelling fair use case. And these are the kinds of cases that I'm really interested in. They're kind of marginal seeming, but really powerful and interesting. And the idea that the copyright system would be brought to bear against this person is just, you know, mind-boggling. That definitely should not happen, and it probably won't, and that's a good thing.
Right, yeah, and Evan was right to tie this into our previous discussion about AIs making music. Apparently, all you would need to do is put some portion of music on a repetitive loop, and you'd have something pretty good.
Yeah. Just lay down a beat. Yeah, I mean, this is definitely highly transformative. And, you know, in the last two episodes of the show, you know, we've talked about situations where it was questionable whether or not the commentary being done by the work was about the work or whether it was about some other subject matter, you know, the whole parody and satire distinction here. What we have is a clear example where this is a commentary on the work itself. It's not a parody, of course, but it's a commentary on the work, which in my view, I think I'm with you, Brandon, this was, you know, because it's so highly transformative, by no means resembling the original object of the work. I think this is a really strong fair use case as well. And plus, it's really interesting. And I mean, it brings up a lot of other notions, too. You know, I enjoyed the comment about how there's, you know, some theorizing that this is sort of built in evolutionarily into our brains because we have a disdain for the unfamiliar. But once we become, what's it called, like mere exposure or something, you know, will make us less suspect of something. It also reminded me of this whole notion of, you know, from the Baroque era, it was really uncommon for Baroque composers. I'm no musicologist. This is just what I've you know, heard on, you know, the Today Show or something like that, that Baroque composers, you know, very seldomly came up with original things, but they would borrow from folk music motifs from that. And that's why it was so popular, because it draws on something that that we know. And it's sort of the same phenomenon, as you mentioned, with sampling. So tons of interesting things with psychology, evolutionary science, copyright. This is it's a really neat story because of that mixture of things there.
Yeah, and there's an interesting tension, because on the one hand, you think, well, gosh, it was so easy for her to make something without even trying, by just sort of grabbing pre-existing stuff and looping it that people would like. And when something is easy, that seems cheap. But then on the other hand, right, it worked. There's value. People really liked it. And mm-hmm. So if what we want is more valuable, interesting art, sort of by any means necessary, then maybe the copyright system should have more respect for mere repetition. Maybe mere repetition is not something that we should suppress or disdain. Maybe that's kind of at the heart of what we want from music. And so people who are playing with repetitive ways of creation are really playing at the heart of what we want as listeners.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there would have to be some kind of time sensitivity to it, though. Did her study, do you know, address that at all? That if something's really repetitive, it seems like you would rapidly tire of it. Maybe you would like it at first, but then, you know, as you continued listening, it would get old. Is that something that she hit on at all?
I didn't see that in the story. And in fact, the mere exposure theory seemed to be almost to the contrary. That is, you know, you have to just loop something for it, or anything, even something that strikes you as annoying at first, with enough exposure will become familiar and therefore fun and acceptable. And, you know, I have lots of personal experiences like this. I mean, I try to be kind of an adventurous listener, and when people tell me something is good, I've had several experiences where, you know, on first listen, I did not agree with whoever recommended this music to me. And I sort of pummel myself with it until I get it. You know, I trust certain people and critics and so on. And so, you know, The Fall is a band that's very repetitive and also kind of grating. But I love them now, and I literally put them on repeat in my dorm room in college, you know, for a week. And that's mm-hmm. and it hit me right on day five. I was like, "This is great." So I've lived the mere exposure theory at least a little bit.
That's funny.
You know, they also, people were kind of puzzled about Ravel's Bolero too in the 20th century about that. You know, that's the piece that's what 17, 20 minutes long, depending on how fast it's played. But it's the same thing repeated over, just, you know, sort of in escalation with new, more instruments from the orchestra added. But it's one of those pieces where, you know, sort of if you buy into this, you can sort of see, like, as you're listening to it, you can like it more as it's actually going on, because you know where it's going, even though it's mm-hmm. it could be grating from one perspective. There's that sense of, well, you see where it's going, and you can kind of experience that escalation, even though you haven't heard it before, because you kind of know the underlying motif. So just neat stuff.
I think we better make Bolero our second MCLA passphrase for this show, because that's nice and memorable. If anyone has listened to Bolero, then they probably have it running through their mind right now. So that's going to be our second phrase for the show. Let's move on. We're going to be negligent and definitely not doing our job here if we don't move on to talk about the music and entertainment case that is going to be heard before the Supreme Court next week, the Aereo case. Okay, this is really a showdown coming on Tuesday. The oral argument will happen. I'm sure there will be tons of coverage of it. And this is going to be one where I download the audio and listen to it for sure, because this is going to be a really, really big case. No matter which way it comes out, there has been a lot of posturing, many amicus briefs filed. In fact, your IP clinic filed one, correct, Brandon?
We did, yeah, on behalf of the Consumers Federation of America and Consumer Union.
So what piece did you guys decide to brief? We should explain for people who aren't familiar with this whole decision-making process and briefing process that there is the ability for parties who are not directly involved in a case to shed light on certain issues and help the court further understand issues that maybe the parties themselves have not had the time or the opportunity to brief because there are page limits to what you can file with the court. So what issue did you guys expound on?
Yeah, we're really, so the role of an amicus is really important to understand here. And I'm glad you sort of started off with that. Because, right, the parties are going to brief the law, and they're going to brief it in depth. And, you know, at a Supreme Court level, you're dealing with the best lawyers in the business, right? And so what we do and what a good amicus, I think, tries to do always is bring an interest to the table that is not otherwise going to be represented, right? And so what we did in our brief was focus on consumers. You know, a lot of the coverage in this of this case in the popular press, and, you know, even especially actually more so in the legal, you know, the legal blogosphere and so on, has been about tech companies on the one hand and broadcasters on the other, or tech companies and content companies as always the dichotomy. And I hate that dichotomy because there are so many other stakeholders in this sphere. And so our goal with our brief was just to shine a light on the fact that consumers are actually the intended beneficiaries of copyright law, right? They are the folks whom progress in the constitutional clause that creates the intellectual property power in Congress. It's all about promoting progress, right? And promoting progress is all about making consumers writ large, in a way I don't like that word, but they're our clients, so we'll go with it, consumers better off, right? And so Aereo, there's just no doubt that Aereo does that. And Aereo is doing that without really doing any cognizable harm to the broadcasters. So what we wanted to point out was, look, free over-the-air television is free. Consumers are entitled to access to it, right? And Aereo is a technology company that is doing the paradigm case of what technology companies do. It is creating the cheapest, easiest way for people to do something that they want to do with stuff that they already have access to, right? So just like Dropbox lets you take your files and do stuff cool, you know, do cool things with your files, access them in different places, sync them across different machines, you know, Aereo lets you take the airwaves, which again are put out there for free to you, and make those airwaves available to yourself on all the different devices that you have. And we also tried to highlight how crummy the market for TV is right now, you know, that it is ripe for disruption, and that, you know, the cable companies are awful. They're running monopolies around the country. Sort of, they have these sort of non-compete arrangements where you really have very little choice in any given market. You can't get the kinds of capabilities that Aereo sells from most cable companies without buying the biggest, nicest, you know, channel packages. And so, you know, Aereo just did a great and classic technology thing, which is to give people a service unbundled from a bunch of crap they don't want. And that's great. And that's competition. And it's going to force other people to lower their prices, which is also great. You know, sometimes I think copyright holders, you know, folks who benefit from copyright forget that, you know, generally speaking, competition is good. And that, you know, consumers getting cheap and easy access to stuff is really good. And that, you know, generally speaking, public policy favors that outcome, not the outcome where a monopolist gets to have total control and extort, you know, huge prices in the process. So that was the story that our brief told, you know, that consumers should be empowered to make these kinds of uses of TV content, and that it will be good for the whole ecosystem because it will force, you know, bloated monopolies to activate, you know, to operate in a more efficient way.
Evan, I know it's hard to guess how this case is going to go, but do you have any thoughts, insights, things you expect to happen at oral argument next week?
Well, I mean, who knows what's going to happen at oral argument? Because those you just never know where the. I expect Justice Thomas to ask a lot of questions. That's no, that's probably not going to happen. I can say that that's probably not going to happen. You know, I mean, I was just thinking about this today. I was trying to just really break this down to its essential elements, the essential point here, and you know, thinking about Aereo and comparing it to Cablevision, and. You know, and I'm coming at this just from a perspective of, you know, I want Aereo to win. I think that innovation should win here. And I mean, you know, like I said, I was just thinking about it in terms of Cablevision. I think that a court could really look at this at a very simple, if they wanted to come at it from just a very simple framework. And sometimes I've been told, you know, courts will decide how they want the outcome to be and then sort of go back in and fill in the analysis, so they could go back in and fill the analysis here of what that portion of the transmit clause means. I mean, how is this really any different? And how is the DVR or remote DVR technology in Cablevision any different than, you know, the ordinary VCR that you have? You're storing it there on your set top, and you're transmitting it. You know, if you're using a VCR, you're transmitting it through a RCA cable or a coaxial cable to your television. What's the fundamental difference between having that stored in the cloud and, you know, transmitted via the internet to your TV? So, you know, if you just get back to that very basic point, if we're going to accept the premise of the Sony Betamax decision that this is okay from a time shifting perspective, and we look at just sort of the fundamental technology of what's going on and sort of allow yourself to be moved along through time with the thinking of Cablevision, then, you know, as far as the ultimate outcome goes, I guess I'm just really trying to talk myself into expecting an Aereo victory here. So, but as far as oral argument goes, it'll be interesting to listen to one way or the other.
Brandon, some of the other points that were raised by the amici who submitted alongside you guys?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, there is a kind of what I would call a war of metaphors or a war of frames, right? And Evan just gave you a really, really good version of the frame that I like too, right? Which is, Aereo is just a VCR on a long cord attached to an antenna on a long cord, and it's all yours. So why does it matter how long the cord is? And there were several folks who weighed in along those lines. So there's a great amicus brief by a bunch of IP professors, including James Gremmelman, one of my favorite IP folks on Twitter, and David Post at Temple University. They were the authors, I think, and then, you know, 20, 30, 40 profs signed on, basically making that argument. This is just a VCR, and you can't really, it's too late to unwind Betamax and pretend that didn't happen. We've got to uphold that basic principle that technology that has lawful uses and time shifting is a lawful use, you know, has to be free to go to people that want it. But there were other amici who said that, you know, look, this is on behalf of broadcasters, who said, look, this is just the other frame, which is this is just cable, right? Cable started, CATV is community antenna television. And so it used to, you know, back in the 70s and before, if you lived down in the valley and you couldn't pick up a signal, somebody would put a big old antenna up on the mountain and run a cord down into the valley and sell you access to the cord. And the broadcaster sued over that twice, and both times they lost. And the Supreme Court made the kind of long cord argument that we're making now. They said, look, it's free over the air. People can have access to this free stuff, and the antenna is just on a long cord. Who cares, right? This guy is just renting technology to people. And so it's a very, very similar argument. And the problem is that then Congress in the 76 Copyright Act decided that they liked the broadcasters better than they liked the cable operators. And so they explicitly overruled those two findings, those two cases, Those cases are called teleprompter and fortnightly, and said, no. And that's why they put in the transmit clause under public performance, section 106, whichever section of 106 is about public performance. There's now the transmit clause that counts as a public performance. And it says, well, any transmission, to the public is also a public performance. And so these guys who own antennas are making transmissions to the public, and that's a performance, and that requires a license. So the broadcasters and their amici are unified in making that kind of an argument, that this is just cable. This is just an antenna, just like cable, and cable has to pay to retransmit our signals, so ARIO should have to pay to retransmit our signals. And in a way, the question's going to come down to whether the justices, see all those little antennas and they say, those are all part of a legit technological, solution that's a lot like a VCR, or if they see all those little antennas and say, oh, come on, that's just one big antenna, and it's just like cable. That's really the war that's going to be waged in the courtroom, I think, next week. And I'm going to be there. I just got admitted to the Supreme Court bar, so I get to walk through the special door, and hopefully there will be a shorter line.
Oh, that is so awesome. Cool. We will definitely tweet your impressions after you go.
I will.
Would love to know the answer to. I think you really just hit on the reason why I think oral argument's going to be, you can't really read the tea leaves from oral argument, but you get a good impression from the questions that the justices ask, how a little bit into their thought processes. Are they viewing ARIO as a white hat or a black hat player in this case? And I think they will tip their hand on that, or at least, the justices asking questions will. By what exactly they pose and their tone and how, what they're trying to suss out from the lawyers arguing in court. Because I think you're absolutely right, Brandon, that someone could look at the tiny little antennas as either a brilliant technological solution to the legal framework as it exists, or as something devious that routes around the legal framework and accomplishes a goal that really the law should not permit. So I think it'll be really interesting to hear how they're probing at the case at oral argument.
I'm curious to see. I'll take a risk, right? I'll take a guess. The two things are safe, and everyone is saying this. We won't get Ginsburg for ARIO, because she is pretty well bought into, she hears a rights holder argument in a very favorable way all the time. There's very little that you can say to her from a rights holder perspective that she's not predisposed to get into. But then Breyer will side with ARIO for the opposite reason. He's even published academic articles sort of skeptical of the reach of copyright. And so I meant to look at Kurtzsang and the breakdown on the Kurtzsang case, because I bet that would also help us. Because so Kurtzsang is a recent Supreme Court case about the first sale doctrine, and mm-hmm. Supap Kurtzsang did something in a way, right, really similar to ARIO, because what Kurtzsang did was he kind of routed around a loophole in the law to make some money. Which is, he had his family in Thailand buy a bunch of foreign cheap versions of textbooks and ship them to him in the U.S., and mm-hmm. he resold them on eBay. And there's a little piece of the Copyright Act that the publisher said, look, this is meant to stop people from doing this kind of arbitrage, buying cheap texts abroad and selling them here. But Breyer said, well, the law... That little bit looks interesting to me, but what's more important to me is the fundamental principle that once you buy something, you own it and you can do whatever you want with it. And that could have a similar breakdown here, where you could say, well, yeah, Congress, you got the transmit, or yeah, broadcasters, you got the transmit clause, but, what's more important to us is the fundamental rights of consumers to watch TV. So I wonder if that breakdown might be predictive. And then the other thing that's interesting is Justice Alito just unrecused himself, mm-hmm. right? So we did have this prospect of a 4-4 split, and just in time to save the day for somebody, perhaps, Justice Alito has unrecused himself, and so now we won't see a tie, probably. We'll see a 5-4 some way or the other, at least.
All right. Well, we will definitely be watching your Twitter stream next week, Brandon, and let us know your thoughts. You know, don't tweet from the courtroom. I don't want you to get tossed out, but you run right out there and start tweeting. Evan, any other thoughts before we move on to our tip and resource?
No, looking forward to how that goes and looking forward to hearing what you have to say about Brandon. Should be cool.
Yes. All right. So our tip actually comes by way of Brandon, who spotted this great article in The New Yorker by Professor Tim Wu called Little Lies the Internet Told Me. And the tip to be gleaned from that article is something called the buy button scam. That's what Professor Wu calls it. And that is the mere fact that oftentimes when you see something on an e-commerce site like iTunes or Amazon that says that you're quote unquote buying something, you're not actually doing that. But the fact that you're presented with a buy button might make you think that you have more rights over that piece of media than you actually do. So it is a bit deceptive and misleading, as Professor Wu points out in his story, and maybe they should do something about using the buy button when you buy movies, ebooks, and digital music. Because when you go deep and read the terms of service, we've talked about this a lot on the show, you're not actually buying anything. You're getting a license to be able to use that media in certain ways. So it's a really fascinating conundrum. We've talked before on the show about when you've amassed a large music and movie collection, whether that's something that can pass in your will. And of course, terms of service come into play there as to whether these things are even transferable. But the tip is that buy button may not mean exactly what you think it means. It's not actually a purchase when you're buying a movie, music, or ebook. And our resources this week, one of them comes from Evan's firm and is a great roundup of the legal implications of Heartbleed. Do you want to expand on this for us a bit, Evan?
Sure. It's a blog post at our firm's blog, infolawgroup.com. Four of my colleagues bound together and drafted this, you know, super Uber blog post talking about some of the legal implications of the Heartbleed vulnerability. So it's a good read. It focuses a lot on, you know, identifying issues, evaluating when an organization, it's written, you know, the intended audience is the at the enterprise level, the organizations who may be affected and their data security may have been compromised by Heartbleed, and a pretty heavy focus on remediation, figuring out whether and to what extent remediation, notice, those types of things may be relevant. So take a look at that. That's at the top of the page. It's the most recent post at infolawgroup.com. Answers some of the intriguing questions that the enterprise, the organization may have now that Heartbleed has been on the market, it's been on the market for a couple of years, but now that we've known about it for a couple of weeks now. It's an interesting read.
Right. And regular listeners of the show know that we aggregate all of the discussion points that we've hit on and our resources and tips at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/255 is our episode this time around. So if you need to go back and refer to anything that we've mentioned today, that's where they'll be for you. We have a couple of additional resources I wanted to throw in just in light of the Aereo case to be argued next week over at SCOTUS blog. Which is the be-all and end-all of Supreme Court coverage. They have a whole page for each and every case that they've been following and covering. So I went ahead and put a link to their Aereo page there because it's got links to all the major docket events in the case, when the argument's going to be, you know, whenever anything happens in the case, it's going to get reflected on that page. So if you need that information, it's there. And then also, if like me and Evan, you're not going to be able to march into the court and hear the argument yourself, we're so jealous, Brandon. you will have the opportunity after the fact at some point to listen to the oral argument at the OYEZ project. That's at OYEZ, OYEZ.org, which eventually posts all the oral arguments heard in the court. I'm not sure what their lag time is these days. Do you know, Brandon?
I think it's pretty fast. I think it's sort of next day was the last I heard.
Great.
Although I think there was a slowdown recently, so I don't know. For a while, it was next day.
Yeah, I remember back in the day when I first discovered them, you used to have to wait quite a while after the argument because it was quite a process to get the recording and then process it and post it. And I think they've streamlined quite a bit, which is a good thing. Guys, this has been just a fascinating discussion today. I'm so excited that we've been able to have it. I learned a lot. Brandon, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us today and give us all your insights. And we hope that your amicus brief finds fertile ground with the justices at the Supreme Court.
Thank you so much. Me too. And can I point to one other resource?
Sure, absolutely.
So when I heard talk about fair use in documentary film, I can't believe I didn't bring up the documentary filmmaker's statement of best practices in fair use. So if folks were listening to discussions about, you know, well, gosh, I had to get permission for everything, that's actually not necessarily the case. I know some people do out of an abundance of caution, but in fact, there are some well-recognized practices where filmmakers are really relying on fair use. And there are lots of folks, including my clinic, who would be happy to help you learn more about fair use and how it works in a documentary film.
I just pulled that up. It's at the Center for Media and Social Impact. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, it's my colleagues at American University who've been doing these best practices statements on fair use. And I've done one for libraries myself. I collaborated with them on this. And these projects are really great because they really provide clear guidance without sort of hamstringing you, basically. So it's good stuff.
Oh, that is good stuff. Thanks so much for bringing that up and for joining us today.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
And thanks again to James Barrett. Fascinating chat with him on an issue that we're sure will continue to unfold and develop, we hope, in positive ways. Evan, it's always fun when we can spitball the future on the show.
It sure is. And I tell you what, this has been, you know, this is up there at the top of some of my favorite episodes. This has been just such an interesting conversation. Brandon, so nice to meet you and talk with you. Really, really enjoyed it. So many provocative things you brought up and talk about. Just really interesting stuff. So from one philosophy major to another, I've really,
yes,
really enjoyed it. Yeah, it gets crazy. I could imagine. It might have been better, you know, if we were in our undergraduate days, you know, on a couch at 3 a.m. drinking beer. But,
I think
how that goes. That's the life of a
philosophy.
Yes. Anyway, fun times. And
absolutely.
Denise, thanks. Denise, thanks for driving the trip so well. You know,
that's my
pleasure. It goes off the rails, as the train goes off the rails. You know?
Yeah, crash. No, it's been really fun for me too. I'm so glad we get to do this show every week. We do it on Fridays at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record live, and you can jump into IRC with us if you like and join us live. That's at irc.twit.tv. If you can't do any of that, that doesn't mean you're going to have to miss out on the show. You just head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive of shows is there. If you prefer to find it on YouTube, which is a great way to go, youtube.com/thisweekinlaw will put you in the right place. We have Facebook and Google Plus pages that we use as well for the show. That's a great place if you want to give us something that won't fit into 140 characters. And often the issues that we talk about will not. But if you want to tweet us and get our attention quickly too, Evan is Internet Cases on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. Email us too. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. However you get in touch with us, please do so. We love hearing from you. We love hearing about your reactions to our discussions, additional thoughts you might have had, things that it made you think about that, you know, was a light bulb going off over your head. Always fun to hear about that. If you have light bulbs for us as to guests we should have on the show, we'd love to hear about those too. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week on This Week in Law.